Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Mike the Gardener podcast, sponsored by those lovely people at Natural Grower, who supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and your houseplants. Hello, 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 and welcome back to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast. How are you all? How's it all going? I often wonder, well, what I mean is I'm quite nosy and I find myself thinking about the space you all garden in around the United Kingdom and indeed the world. I've got people listening from all over the world. So hello to you if you're in the United Kingdom and indeed if you're outside of the United Kingdom. So where do you garden? Is it a balcony, a window box, a large rambling country estate, or perhaps a regular garden or yard? Let me know where you garden so I can fulfill my nosy tendencies. The reason for mentioning this today particularly is because for this week's episode, I head to Great Chalfield Manor Garden near Melksham in Bradford-on-Avon in the United Kingdom to chat to a previous guest on the podcast, garden writer, journalist, author, garden consultant, and indeed garden designer, Naomi Slade. After being taken for a personal tour of the garden by owner Pats, Naomi and I found a perfect pew at the back of the manor looking out over the perfectly planted well court and the beautiful garden beyond. I invited Naomi back to the podcast to chat about her new book, Lilacs, Beautiful Varieties for Home and Garden, published by Pavilion Books on the 7th of April. So, of course, we chatted extensively about the book, how it came about, the stunning photography from photographer Georgiana Lane, Lilacs, and yes, you've guessed it, much, much more. So, a returning guest to the podcast, Naomi Slade, welcome back. It's lovely to meet you here today.
Hi, Mike. It's fantastic to be here. Great Chalfield Manor.
Isn't it beautiful? We've just had a wander around the garden and taken around the garden by owner Pats Fuller. Just incredible.
The roses are just, they're amazing. I've been taking notes all the way around and some of the clematis. I mean, it's beautifully done, really painterly, don't you think, Mike?
I think so. And I think for the time of year, Pats was actually saying it's that difficult time of year, July, but for a difficult time of year, it's looking particularly beautiful. The roses, as you say, in front of us. So that's a Buddleia globosa, I think, in front of us against the building there. Just stunning.
I think it might be one of the most difficult times of year I've ever seen. It's really, really magnificent. It's, you know, salvias, the dahlias are coming out. You know, it's going to run and run. I think it's all in the deadheading, she was saying, and the horse manure.
Horse manure, yeah. Horse manure, deadheading, and some rain.
Yes, yes. We've got a little bit of rain today.
Well, we're here today to talk primarily, you've been busy since we last spoke in September, to talk about your new book, which I have in front of me here, Lilacs, Beautiful Varieties for Home and Garden. Tell me, how did the book come about? Because I think when we spoke last, you were at the final stages, that was September last year?
Yes, that was right. We were in the edits then. So it was almost there, but books tend to be quite a long process. And yes, the book came about because, it's the latest in the series of flower books I've been doing with Pavilion Publishers and the American photographer based in Paris, Georgiana Lane, who just does the most gorgeous photographs.
I'd like to chat about Georgiana later, actually, just to find out how that collaboration works, but we'll come back to that.
We're dedicated and fiery is how it works, both of us.
So we were talking about how the book actually came about. So it's one of a number of flower books that you've now written.
Yes, that's right. So in this particular series, I've done dahlias and I've done lilies and I've done hydrangeas and I've done lilacs. And I'm actually just finishing the next one off now, which is going to be very exciting and hopefully will be extremely popular when it comes out next year.
Are you able to give us any hints or am I pushing on a closed door here?
Well, I can. It's not a shrub, I can tell you that.
Okay.
And it's driven very strongly by the floristry market, the lifestyle market. I mean, garden plants, yes. Interesting, exciting plants, yes. But very, very beautiful and very of the moment.
So I wondered, with the books that you've written to date,
What makes a plant something that goes onto the Naomi Slade wish list for writing a book? What qualities does it need to possess? Or is it a case that a publisher will come to you and say, I'd like you to write about lilies?
Well, in terms of the flower books, we tend to sit down every year or so and we go, okay, what should we do? What do we like? What are people interested in? What is the flavour of the month or the year or the decade? What are people posting on Instagram? What are people getting very, very excited about? And it's a combination of things that are popular in the garden and things that are popular in the home, as the title clearly says. And everyone brings things to the table. They're like, no, I'm not writing about that. No, I'm not photographing that. No, I think they would totally sell loads of these. Oh, we all like that one. Let's do that, is basically how it goes for these ones.
And so lilacs, how familiar were you with lilacs before the book? I mean, we all, as gardeners, we dip our toes and we have a fair bit of knowledge about most things. But you've got a lot of information in this book. So what was your starting point?
That's an interesting question because it's the starting point where I start pretty much everything from, which is an avid curiosity and inquiring mind. I mean, I have, of course, grown lilacs. I've had them in my gardens as I've gone through my life. I have propagated them. I have put them with tulips in vases. I wouldn't say I'd ever have a massive collection, or I'd thought about them too hard, other than being something I very much liked at that time of year and I enjoyed it and I would generally like more. But that's one of the challenges, was that's kind of what everybody in the UK thinks about lilacs. Mm. So compared to, for example, France and America and Russia and even Japan, the availability of cultivars is relatively limited. We've only got one national collection. So, I mean, it was very much kind of looking beyond the borders to find the information.
Okay, I remember when we spoke last time, you talked about your starting point. You brainstorm ideas about information you have off the top of your head, and you soon discover that you actually know a lot more than perhaps you initially thought.
Yes, that is the case. I mean, it does vary from plant to plant. But you very, very, very rapidly find out that there's lots of things you haven't thought about, and this is a case in point because it's not very Britain-centric. I mean, lilacs are native to Eastern Europe and into Asia, and they were very, very heavily developed in France by the Lemoyne family, and they zipped over to America and they had some very key breeders there, and it became almost sort of like a national flower. I mean, it's one of those things people go, it's nostalgic, it reminds me of grandmother's garden. It does for everybody, but the French and the Americans particularly are very keen on that. So it's one of the things we are trying to find out of it, and quite a lot of the information is in French. and one of the challenges also is that it's important to include varieties people can get hold of, but that varies across the world. You know, local political decisions haven't really helped in that lately.
Yeah. And you actually profile 63... lilacs in the book, and I wondered, how did you select those 63 lilacs? And you talked about a national collection. Do you go to the national collection and have a look at the lilacs and see which ones catch your eye? How did that work?
Again, and this was our second lockdown book, the first being Lilies, and travel was difficult, but also there is only one national collection in the UK now. It's in Leeds, Golden Acre Park, and it's Lemoyne cultivars, I believe. And it has become quite run down. There were others, but one of the chaps who ran it has got very old. But he certainly hasn't got an open national collection anymore. And there used to be some at Kew. There was a famous Baron Organ song called Come Down to Kew in Lilac Time. It isn't far from London, but it might be lilac time, but I think the lilacs have possibly ebbed somewhat there. So in some ways it was quite heavily research-based, and Georgiana in America and Paris had the same challenges. So in this case we talk about a lot of the lilacs that are available to buy, the ones which are good, ones interesting. It's sort of quite discursive. The profiles hang on the photographs to a great degree, so we worked very, very hard to make sure that there was a selection of them which were widespread, old style goodens, and people could go, I like that lilac, I want that lilac, I can get that lilac. And then there are things which are sort of up and coming, things that are a bit sort of weird and wacky, And there are variegated leaved lilacs, and the International Lilac Society is very thorough on such things. It's about as specialist as you can get.
I think for me, my knowledge of lilacs before reading the book, the Lemoine family are very involved, or were involved, with the cultivation of lilacs. And I think the very creamy coloured lilac, I want to say Madame Lemoine was one of the ones I knew of before the book.
Yeah, Madame Lemoine is a creamy white lilac. It's very, very good. It's very solid. But, you know, Emile and all the other Lemoines, Victor, have all got lilacs named after them.
And I think for me, because you've actually split the 63 profiled lilacs into four categories. You've got fantastic frills, cool perfection, delicate delights, and sumptuous sophistication. And I found myself having a little look through. Now, I'm, like many gardeners, I guess, the colour is quite important for me. And I wondered, sort of like, what do you have any particular lilacs that have come out as your favourites following the book?
Definitely. I can tell you my least favourite as well. Start off my least favourite lilacs. I don't like the one called Primrose, which is a kind of very, very pale, buttery yellow colour, which I just think it's an aberration. It's like a crime against lilac kind in my mind. it's not any of the things that I feel it should be. And I'm not that keen on sensational purple sensation, which is the it's got purple leaves and with a white stripe. Sorry, it's purple flowers with a white stripe, and it's very, very bold, but it's a little bit brash. It's a little bit tasteless to my mind.
I'm looking down because I've written a list of my favourites from the book. And Primrose was on there, but I've crossed it out, as you'll see, Buttery Primrose. I've been attracted to Pasteur, Angel White, but my favourite colours, I like Etna, that smouldering maroon. And now I'm going to have to take a run up to this one. Znamia Lenina?
I think Znamia Lenina, something like that. It's a Russian one. It's one of a very, very good series of Russian lilacs. By Leonid Kolesnikov. Okay. And he did some of my favourites as well. So there's also Krasovitska Moskvy, which is Beauty of Moscow, and Nadezhda, which means hope, which is a sort of pale blue one. And they are absolutely gorgeous. But there's some of the best lilacs to be bred in recent years is the Russian lilac group. But there's a real problem getting them out of Russia, and there's the trade, there's all sorts of restrictions that I'm not entirely familiar with. Mm. But wonderful, wonderful Russian-bred lilacs exist. But the Krasovitska Moskvy, the three we've mentioned, right, are available in Britain, and they are very, very pretty, yes.
And for each lilac, each of the 63 lilacs, you actually go into the height and spread of the plant, the flower size, the scent. You actually describe the scent, which I think is, wow, as a non-writer, how do you describe a scent? But you do it perfectly. Another one that caught my eye, President Lincoln, you describe the fragrance as a trip down memory lane. Such an evocative thing to write about.
It's a very, very nice lilac, President Lincoln. It's a beauty. It's up there as one of my favourites. It's possibly the best blue. It's beautiful. It's clear. It's gorgeous. I do like the blue ones, the lilacs. Firmament is another one, and I like Etna as well. There are some lilacs that smell rum. I mean, some led to believe. I've not actually met them because I don't think people go, oh, yes, look at this lilac, it smells rubbish. but, you know, that combination of colour and fragrance it just makes the plant iconic, doesn't it?
It does, but you also go on under the profiled lilacs to say how it works in the garden, what you can use it for. You talk about its figure and possible uses. Some could be used as hedging, some are standalone. But you also describe how to design with lilacs as well. And I think a great gardener, as we can see here today, is putting plants together so they work well with each other. So for any of us who may be thinking about planting a lilac, you give us some great tips on how to use them design-wise in the garden.
Well, lilacs are one of those plants that are a little bit like magnolias. Everyone goes, oh, yes, absolutely brilliant. I love them when they're doing their thing. They're really boring the rest of the time, which is a little bit harsh, I think, because they can be substantial, but as you've noted, some are big and some are small, and they can be quite versatile. I was in France, I think, a few years ago, and they were at the car park of the chateau was bordered by this incredibly long lilac hedge, which I think was Syringa myrii. It might have been Palabin, which turned out to be the one which is in my own garden when I moved there, as which is used as a hedge at a much smaller level. But if you leg lilacs up, if you get the tall ones that aren't too suckery, you can use them as a small tree. You can use them as height and focal point in a herbaceous border. You can use the space underneath them to plant bulbs, plant grasses. So even when they're bare in winter, you've got something going on. So going, yes, it's a lilac tree, it has flowers. No, I'm not interested, it doesn't have flowers, isn't really thinking about the other things a lilac can do. They're not brilliant in containers, but one of the drivers for development at the moment is creating, well, reblooming lilacs, as the Americans say, so ones with more than one flush of flower.
Okay, that's interesting.
Ones with autumn colour, which is not common in lilacs, but some of the ex-hyacinthiflora varieties do have it.
So you mean in terms of foliage colour in the autumn?
Yes, that's what they're aiming for. They would like sort of some autumn colour. I mean, there's a little bit, but it's not sort of pop your eyes out sort of colour. So that seems to be encouraged. And, of course, compact size, because lilacs have big, long roots that go down, and they have a very, very spready sort of feeding network of roots. So you need quite a wide, substantial pot if you want to grow lilacs in a pot, and getting one that's small enough. I mean, there are a few. Mm-hmm. I mean, compact lilacs include the Blue Meringue series, which is a more modern set, which is quite widely available. There's Flower Festa, there's Tinkerbell, which I'm not sure is available in this country yet. And then there's Palabin, which is in a hefty enough pot, you'll get away with it. So in terms of legging it up, using it at a hedge, underplanting, there are... You know, it's about being creative with the plant, really, and then teaming it with the other things that are going on and thinking about it more than it's, you know, one glorious flush of interest. Because, you know, it's a nicely shaped green foliage shrub. So deploy.
And again, we talked about this last time, but you garden design as well. So all of this information comes from the vantage point of actually having done this and worked as a designer.
Yes, very much so. I mean, one of the great things is to find new plants, work with plants that exist, think of ways to get interest, pack as much interest in as possible. I mean, that is a key thing. You know, you can do it with large numbers of things, or you can think about the detail, and you can think about the facility for something to just give a little bit more, that in terms of structure, in terms of sculptural qualities, in terms of what you put next to it to make it go for further, really. And, you know, visiting gardens is, you know, just fills you with ideas, new plants, new cultivars, new combinations. It's a lovely thing to be able to do.
And I guess, talking of combinations and where we are today at Great Chalfield, we've seen there's a lot of clematis. So I guess after that flush of flowers with your lilacs, to grow a clematis up through could provide more interest and more vertical accent and interest in the garden.
Yes, that is true. The one thing I'd be a little bit cautious about with clematis would be because they need pruning, like all early flowering shrubs, they need pruning after they finish blooming. So if you haven't pruned your lilacs yet, chaps, this is the time to do it quickly before the sort of flowers initiate for next year. But as you don't want to kind of prune out and damage all your delicate clematis stems as you take out the bits of lilac.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Very good point. So now is the time. We're July, so you're at the cusp of doing the pruning for next year.
Well, I've done mine, which is, you know, I try and do it as soon as possible after the flowers are finished, personally. But then also it's nice to cut some of the flowers. So I see sort of cutting the blooms as a way of sort of getting ahead on the pruning. So I cut the branch out that I want to go, then I take the flower from that. So it's a kind of two-stage process. I do most of my pruning for most things in a two-stage process.
Okay. Now we've touched on both the common name and the Latin name, lilacs and syringa. Can you tell us what the origins are of the two names?
Both are really interesting, actually. So lilacs entered Western cultivation with Auger Gillin, Count de Busbecq.
That's easy for you to say.
I've been practicing. who was sent to as an ambassador to the courts of Istanbul, and he was responsible for bringing an awful lot of plants back, because he was stooging around going, I like that, I like that, and he acquired quite a lot of different things. But one of the things that he brought back from Istanbul when he returned to Austria was a little sprout of something which he called a lilac, or a Turkish ahola, which is a Turkish elderberry, which I'll come on to in a moment, actually. The word lilac actually means bluish in Persian, so it's
okay.
It's kind of the bluish version of oranges.
And what about the Latin name syringa?
Well, syringa, there's a very nice story, and it's named after the Greek nymph Syrinx, who's being pursued by amorous Pan, and she was a very chaste and dainty sort of nymph and didn't want to be involved in any frolics with cheeky gods. So yeah. She ran away, it's like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. And she passed a stream or a lake, and the river nymphs took pity on her and turned her into a reed. And the frustrated god, he picked the reed and he turned it into a pipe. And she had to travel with him always, playing a wistful tune on his little panpipes. So Syrinx is syringa. And why I say that it was about the Turkish elderberry is that they will similarly make very pipes, good pipe stems, because they have a very easily removable pith. Pipe plant, pipe stem, something like that, is another sort of old-fashioned name for a lilac, but also things like elderberry too.
Wow, that's incredible. It's lovely to hear where these names come from, both sort of like the common and the Latin names. And obviously there are a few common names for lilacs. Now, the book is Beautiful Varieties for Home and Garden. So I'm no flower arranger, but for me, some of the information in the book gives me some hints and tips as to what I can display my indoor lilac flowers with. Now, I guess you have a bit of an added advantage. You have a daughter, Holly, who is a florist. So tell us about lilacs inside the house, and tell us about Holly and how she's working.
Well, it's a source of great pride, to be honest. She is very creative. She's done photography. She's done art. When she did a show garden with me about 5 years ago, I thought, okay, I need hands. I need people. I need, you know, a wing woman. And so I took her with me, and we created this show garden based on the Wisley Winter Walk. I sort of pointed her at things, and she was there beautifully creating planting combinations, and she absolutely loved it.
Was she aware that she had an interest or a talent at that point?
Well, she was quite young. She was 15 or 16 at the time, and you know how it is if you're brought up in a botanical family. You have gardens inflicted on you all the time and plants, and they're all around, and, you know, mother's potting up on the table. You can't, you know, there's certainly no footballs in my garden. So it's fair to say that my children probably come pre-indoctrinated. But the putting together the forms and the colours, she had this kind of epiphany. This is what she really, really wanted to do with life. And she's always made wreaths since she was, you know, pre-10, wreaths for Christmas and putting together flower arrangements. And recently, as we came out of lockdown, she trained as a professional florist. And now it's this wonderful thing, all the things that I've planted over the years. She's cutting, and she's into British flowers, roses that are beautifully scented, using, you know, wild material foraged from our farm, like grasses and foliage and all sorts of things. And it's wonderful to see her experiment and use the flowers in a different way, in a far more sophisticated way than I might arrange flowers, perhaps.
Well, certainly more sophisticated than I will ever arrange flowers. But I have taken inspiration from Holly's Instagram page. So for people looking for more information about flower arranging and Holly's page, where can they go to?
Oh, yes. On Instagram, it's Flowers from the Glade, Holly Vlasnik. And she's doing some very, very nice things. And she's very into local British flowers, you know, the grown, not flown thing. Yes, hopefully she'll be able to move into event floristry, and in fact she's starting some event floristry actually today, so it's all going terribly well.
Oh, well, good luck, Holly, with that one. So for me, as a novice flower arranger, You helpfully give us some tips on what we can display lilac flowers with, but you also give us some advice on what the colours of the flowers are. And there's one, again, one of my favourites. There's a cut flower. President Lincoln, you describe as resembling a bunch of sky. Just such a wonderful way to describe that particular lilac.
It's very, very beautiful. I mean, for me, there are challenges in, I mean, I've written a book on snowdrops, and not to have every third word to being small, white, green, or February, is it takes a certain focus, dare I say it, possibly skill. But what I tend to do is I look at the picture, I look at the plant, and I kind of meditate on it, and I let my mind wander. It's like, what is it making me think of? What is it making me feel? What's ringing the bells in my mind? Mm. What can I smell? Almost, what does it taste like? I mean, lilac flowers are in fact edible.
That's something else I learned from the book. Yeah,
I don't like them much, but they are. And that's what happened with President Lincoln. But I do that with an awful lot of the things that I write about. It's like, what can I say about this? You know, blue isn't good enough. Lilac is a very obvious word to use in a book in lilacs. Mm-hmm. So the descriptions come from a kind of almost a meditative state.
Are you conscious when you're writing about your choice of words? Do you actually find yourself stopping and thinking, I need to up my game here. I need to think of a new way of conveying the colour, the scent?
I get out of bed every morning saying I need to think of a new way of doing things, because, I mean, writing about plants, about gardens, about everything is very, very established. And while there's nothing new under the sun, there are certain phrases and certain descriptions which are well-worn, overused. Mm. And I don't really want people to pick up my books or my magazine columns or anything else and go, well, I've read that before. Mm. And it needs to be fresh, it needs to be lively, it needs to be engaging. And it's about making it readable. It's about making people feel excited about it, even if they're not that into lilacs or that into hydrangeas. You go, well, actually, that sounds really pretty. You know, maybe I'll keep an eye out for it. Maybe I'll see it. So, yes, that pursuit of words and descriptions is a constant.
And I guess, as you say, for yourself, when it's very easy to trot out the same old phrases. We hear it on the television, we see it in some publications, the same old phrases come thick and fast. Oh, I've seen this before. So for you, and to maintain your interest in writing, I guess that's quite key.
Yes. It's a significant part of what I do. And in order to maintain, I mean, if I bore myself, then I'm stuffed, really, aren't I?
Well, yes, I guess. And so are we in turn as well. It's clearly not just about the words, the pictures in the book. You work with Georgiana Lane, and you've worked with Georgiana on a number of your books now. Tell us about that collaboration. How did it come about? How do you choose what pictures, what plants?
It's a very much sort of collaborative and iterative process. So she was invited to do the first two books in the series that I didn't write, which were Roses and Peonies, because she's got a very distinctive style. She's very well known, and the editor at the time thought it would be wonderful to have a book on roses. So I spent a lot of time, you know, photographing David Austin roses and other sorts. And then several books down the line, I was invited to join in with dahlias. So we hadn't met, and we came together with the project. And it turns out we got on famously. And she's fantastic. She's incredibly intense. She's incredibly focused, which is something you say about some of the best photographers in general, with no pun intended. But for hydrangeas, I think it was, she photographed over for 3.5 days in the States, in France, and in the UK. Bam, bam, bam. And she absolutely knows what she wants. So I'm very, very comfortable that I'll get what I need to write with. So what we do is we have a bit of a brainstorm. We talk about key varieties. We talk about interesting varieties. I come up with a list. She shows me what she's already got. Then we go, okay, where can we get the other ones that we need? And then we identify it. We speak to experts. We speak to collections. And keeping it interesting. So, I mean, not everything I write about is easy to grow, but it might be deeply cool or deeply ugly or, you know, it might be the lilac that smells rotten, the only one. So I like to have things which are there for interest's sake rather than being a bit of a kind of plant catalogue. And then we just take it from there, and then she shoots basically everything she can find, and I cherry pick everything that I want to and write it in phases, and then I leave myself a space of about sort of 10 varieties at the end of the list, because she'll come in the 11th hour and go, I found these brilliant things, we absolutely have to include them, and I'm going, oh my god, we have to. But we've got a pretty solid working relationship, and the more we talk, the easier and slicker it is, so it's good.
So how many books have you now collaborated on?
Dahlias, hydrangeas, lilies, lilacs, and the one we're just tidying up at the moment. So this is our fifth. I don't know how it's going forward. All these are, by the way, available on my website, www.naomislade.com/shop. We don't know what's going to happen. We're just tidying this up, then we're going to have a conversation about what happens next. But I've also, in a coming up sort of way, I've just started my ninth book with a different publisher again, which is something completely different. It's going to be fresh and exciting.
When we spoke last, you talked about writing a novel, and I wondered, is that something that's still on your agenda? I'm trying to scrutinise your face as if there's a knowing, there's nothing being given away here at all. Is a novel still on the agenda?
Well, it's there. I've been sending it out to agents. Agents take forever to come back if they do at all. So it's given how much I write in general, it's a frustratingly long process for me. It's like, I went, yes, crack on right the second. And it's like, so yes, it exists. Hopefully at some point it'll see the light of day. I will keep you posted.
We'll look forward to that. Now, what I wanted to ask is, quite a few books down the line, when you actually see the book in front of you, is it still a magical moment to actually see this that will be in a bookshelf that I've brought along here today? Is that still magical for you?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I go into every bookshop I pass to see if they've got any. It's really nice the first day it turns up, because you look through and you go, oh, because you start off going and it's a project, and then, you know, or you might love it. And then about sort of halfway through, you absolutely hate it. You never want to see another one. You have to have this kind of, the scales fall from your eyes and it becomes, you know, the most painful thing in the world. And by the time you've finished, you kind of, it goes beautiful again, and then you're kind of over it. So when it actually arrives on your doorstep, you know, some months later, it's like a wonderful present. It's like, oh my god, it looks amazing, I can't believe we did that, that's fantastic. And it's every time, so it's a great achievement.
So you've written about gardens and plants for a few years, and when we spoke last time, we spoke from your garden in Bristol, which you described, I don't know if you remember how you described your garden.
I don't, actually.
You described it as awkward but relatable. And we're here today in Chowfield Manor, a beautiful garden. And I just wondered, sort of like with the gardens you've written about, the plants you've written about, your dream garden, what might it look like? What might the views be? Where would it be?
Oh, I'm very, very greedy.
be greedy. Tell us everything.
I'd have to have everything. I'd have to have an orchard that isn't like my current orchard, which is on acid bog. Yeah, I would have a beautiful orchard with a huge collection, even bigger than my existing one, of apple trees and pears. I'd have quince would flourish, and maybe I could grow things like kiwi fruit and peaches. So I'd like a walled garden in this. What would the views be? It would need to be on a slope in the mountains. And with a glorious view. I don't think I'd need sea, but I would need, there'd have to be water. I'm not fussed about lakes, but there'd have to be running water, so cascades and streams and rills and things like that. I do very much like water in the garden. And there would need to be basically everything I love. There would have to be roses and lilacs and woodlanders and the best bulb collection you've ever seen. You know, meadows, and it would be absolutely alive with wildlife.
And do you have a go-to or a preferred colour palette? Is there a sort of like a Naomi palette of colours that you find yourself going back to?
That's quite an interesting question, because my garden at home in Bristol is, I've got a column on it in Garden News, so it needs to have something of interest going on all the time, and it needs to be my lab and my backdrop to my photographs. And it tends to have lots of pinks and purples and hot oranges, and also quite a lot of detailed things that I can get excited about. I mean, it is awkward, you know, it's shady and heavy clay, and you know, but it's.
But it's packed. It's and again, you described it last time as being packed. You have everything that you want to have in that garden. You've got your little greenhouse. You've got fruits.
Yes, I've got chilies. I've got specimen trees. I've got climbers. I have got everything in the whole world in this microcosm. And it's even more packed than it was when you saw it, Mike. But what I was going to say actually is, do I have a go-to colour palette when I'm designing? I have my own tastes, of course. For example, I don't like salvia hot lips. I wouldn't plant it in my own garden.
You're pushing on an open door.
And I like salvias, but not that one. Yeah. Even dodgy about amethyst lips, to be honest. Yeah. But because my formal gardening career started off in events management and show garden design and stand design, actually I create something which is a design that fits in the space. So it doesn't need to be something that is necessary to my taste, but I know when it looks good. So I can do a strongly designed taste in any colour palette, and I do the thing that seems to work best in the context of the place and any key existing plants and other people's taste, whatever's actually required, almost independent of... It's about the art, I suppose.
So in terms of colour... I love plummy, winey colours. I love the colour of Cotinus, royal purple. I'm always attracted to that. Do you have a colour that if you see a plant somewhere, it's like, oh, it's that colour?
I like purples. I like blues. I'll take almost any shade of blue. I love it. I like fresh whites. I don't know. It's very hard to go wrong with plants. Mm. There aren't many plants, and even the ones that are yellow that some people get about, actually, it's how nature made them. In my head, I shouldn't like apricot roses. I love apricot roses. So I wouldn't, other than salvia hot lips, I wouldn't actually cast anything into darkness.
So we've touched on salvias, and we've both sort of like... shuddered at the thought of hot lips. Are there any salvias that you particularly adore, given that we've touched on salvias and there's some beautiful salvias here today?
I've got black and blue, which is very nice. And I've also got Nachtblinde, which it does well for me, given how awkward and shady my garden is. It overwinters, it does nicely, it takes very easily from cuttings. So that's probably my favourite at the moment, Nachtblinde. It's something I'd like more salvias in my life. Packing them in is the problem.
Yeah, packing it in, but they're quite easy to propagate as well. Again, I have Nachtblinde and Black and Blue. I think the very popular Amistad, had almost forgot the name there. Amistad is also very popular as well.
I've got that one as well, yeah. Yes.
What next from Naomi Slade? We've talked on garden design, writing... garden consultancy, the floristry side of things. You're writing a book at the moment, you're finishing off. Anything else sort of like in the pipeline that you can tease us with?
Well, all those things and more. I do a lot of writing. I've done increasing amounts of design in the last year or two. I've got this new and exciting commission for a book that I have to finish by the autumn, that's another passion project for me. It's been in the pipeline for a while, and I'm absolutely thrilled that it's going to be out next year. So that's going to be very, very exciting. I love consulting on things. I don't know. I do stuff that I want to do, and that's what excites me. I mean, I want to do some more travelling, some more looking at plants in the wild. I don't know, watch this space. I never know what I'm going to do until fairly shortly before I do it. I think, actually, that'd be brilliant. I'm bored now. I'm going to go and do that thing. So I surprise myself quite often.
When we spoke last, I asked you if you had a favourite amongst your books, and you alluded to Orchard Odyssey as being a favourite. And I just wondered, has Lilacs usurped Orchard Odyssey, or is Orchard Odyssey still up there?
I love my orchards. I love my fruit trees with an absolute, absolute passion. I mean, I love my snowdrops as well. I love many other things. So I love my snowdrops. I love my orchards. I'm very excited about the books coming out. Everything, like some of all the plants that I've written about in the flower series, I'm definitely going to be planting lilacs everywhere I go, in addition to my my passion for fruit trees. No garden is complete without one. But the great thing about lilacs is they're incredibly popular, as indeed with hydrangeas. So, I mean, those are probably the most popular books I've written. So hydrangeas have been translated into both Russian and simplified Chinese.
Oh, okay.
And lilacs was in the top five Amazon.com perennial gardening books for well over a month, and it got to number one several times, and it got to less than 4,000 in the overall Amazon ranking. So somebody in America has been buying it like nobody's business. So I think it's going to be very, very popular.
And I guess there must be. I mean, I've looked through this, and there's a few plants on there, a few lilacs that I've highlighted. Plant sales must actually go up in the same way that when Delia mentions a particular product. I wonder if there's the Naomi Slade effect of. There's a new book out, the sale of lilacs is going to soar this year.
I don't know, it's an interesting one. I mean, it's plant sales or this sort of things is quite heavily influenced by things like lifestyle trends and floristry. I mean, think of your sort of changing room style garden design. It was gardening and then all of a sudden it was a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And then everybody was doing it and then everybody wanted decking. In the same way, the floristry trends and the lifestyle trends, I mean, what's massive in America sort of translates across the globe and what's massive. I mean, and there's always lots of development in places like Japan. And things like Instagram and what is posted, I mean, it has global reach. So you can tell what's bubbling up, and then you can write about it. And as I speak to the experts, as I speak to the nursery people, you know, I tend to give them a little bit of notice that I'm writing about this, not necessarily because I'm writing about this, because it's a kind of a distilled reaction to a greater trend. And if that's the way things are going, I mean, it often is very frustrating to see a brilliant plant and not be able to source it. So the opportunities for people to actually think about it, I mean, there aren't many lilac specialists in the UK. There's Gobbett's Nursery in the Welsh Borders, I think, and there are a few other people who do a decent number. But it would be lovely if everybody managed to sort of, if every nursery actually contained a few interesting, exciting lilacs so that we could all plant more of them.
Yes, hear, hear to that one. So there's a few on my list that I need to try and locate and get in the garden. Naomi, thank you for chatting again today. It's been glorious out here. The sun is coming out. We're at Great Chalfield, and it's a wonderful garden to come and visit. Near Melksham, I think?
Yes, Bradford-on-Avon,
Bradford-on-Avon.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful Cotswold stone. Absolutely gorgeous little manor house. Fantastic borders. There's rill, there's orchards with roses growing up them. I mean, it's really dreamy, this place.
Yeah, and for difficult July, it's looking particularly lovely.
It most certainly is.
Thank you, Naomi. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here.
So, another great gardening book for the Christmas, birthday, Mother or Father's Day, or just any day book wish list. As you've heard from our chat, just about everything you could possibly need to know about lilacs has been covered in the book. It's beautifully written with stunning photography from Georgiana Lane. And you can get a copy of the book by heading to Naomi's website, naomislade.com/shop. My personal thanks to Robert and Pat Floyd for their hospitality at Great Chalfield Manor Gardens in Bradford-on-Avon. If you find yourself in the area, it's definitely a gem of a garden and definitely one you need to go and have a visit. You'll not be disappointed, I can assure you. Now, I think you're all getting to know me a little bit better by now, and I just love, as you know, having a good old natter with my guests. So if you have any suggestions for plant experts, nurserymen and women, broadcasters, writers, journalists, head gardeners, or indeed anyone in gardening and horticulture or a garden designer, do drop me a line at the show's email address, mikethegardener01@gmail.com, and that's Mike with an M-I-C. Or you can follow me on Instagram, where you can keep track of my garden and follow me live on a Sunday at 10 o'clock British time, where I spend about an hour wandering around the garden and answering all of your questions. And I'm Mike_thegardener, and that's Mike with an M-I-K-E. And you can follow me there and message me directly on Instagram, again, with any questions you may have or suggestions or just comments or feedback about the podcast. It's lovely to hear from you, and I'll give you a shout out, of course. As always, I'll be here again next week with another fascinating guest or a chat, and I look forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, happy gardening. See you next week. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.